Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
The information depicted in this podcast is purely for informational purposes only. Please consult your healthcare professional before making any changes to your lifestyle or routine.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Boost Your Biology podcast. My name is Lucas, and I'm the founder of Ergogenic Health. Together in this podcast series, we will go underground to explore cutting-edge health and human performance insights that you simply cannot search on Google to help you upgrade your existence. So without any further ado, let's jump into today's episode. What's up, fam? Lucas here. I want to take a moment to announce a couple of things to all my new listeners on the podcast. Firstly, if you're looking to upgrade your brain function, whether that be through reducing brain fog, enhancing verbal fluency, improving confidence, motivation, drive, or even orgasm intensity, then check out my nootropics course, which can be found on my website at www.ergogenic.health. And you'll see at the top, it will say courses, where you can use the discount code BYB15 to save 15% off. In addition, I also have a sleep optimization masterclass and a testosterone optimization course that can also be accessed on my website. Again, you can use the same discount code BYB15 to save 15% off. I wanted to quickly give a shout out to my friends over at Neurotech. They've recently launched a new nootropic formula that's designed to have an anti-stress effect and help one with their sleep. This particular hot chocolate formula is designed to help one unwind after a hard day at work. It contains some pretty unique ingredients such as magnesium glycinate, L-theanine, and some other adaptogenic herbs. You can use the discount code BYB to save 20% off on all Neurotech products. That's BYB to save 20% off. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Boost Your Biology podcast. Today, I'm very excited because we have a fellow underground and very well-known biohacker. He goes by the name Simland. And if you ever come on YouTube, you'll know Simland straight away. He is probably one of the most well-known content creators in the space of longevity, fasting, autophagy. And so today's episode will be covering all things related to autophagy and longevity, hormesis and stress adaptation, minerals in the body, sleep optimization, and building muscle and strength. So, Simland, welcome to the show, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me and glad to speak to you.
Awesome. So, Sim, do you want to let my listeners know a little bit about you and how you became so fascinated with the biohacking space?
Back in high school, I got into weightlifting and bodybuilding. And that's where I, started to learn more about nutrition, different kinds of exercises, and just wanting to, improve mostly my strength and performance and the body composition. So that was like, the main first reasons why I got into, let's say, health and performance optimization in general. And from there, I just also, stumbled upon the concept of biohacking and everything related to that, like the longevity aspect, the cognition, the brain, the sleep, that sort of thing, and kind of realized how interconnected all those things are. And I decided to delve deeper into these topics, and as I did that, I also started to write my blog about this, and from there I started the YouTube channel, and just has grown from there.
Yeah, I mean, for those who haven't actually checked out Simlan's content on YouTube, he posts some really epic videos around fasting and longevity and aging. So I guess, Sim, let's sort of start with autophagy and longevity. Do you want to sort of run my audience through what this term autophagy actually means?
Yeah, well, autophagy translates from Greek into self-eating. And it's this intracellular process where your dysfunctional cell components and like debris, junk, and old mitochondria, whatnot, they're going to be recycled and back into energy. And this, process is very, let's say, important for longevity because of, as we get older, then one of the hallmarks of aging is this accumulation of waste and dysfunctional mitochondria and mitochondrial damage, etc. With autophagy, you're essentially helping to clear them out. And then in addition to that, autophagy is also, very, let's say, critical for other processes in the body, like the immune system. It helps to eliminate pathogens, bacteria, viruses, and even things like fat oxidation and fat burning. So it also helps with like breaking down triglycerides and lipids. So it is like a very essential process in the body. And, there are, let's say, benefits to it, but there are also some negative side effects to that. So it's like a matter of dose of, how much do you want? But like for a healthy body, you do need like some aspects of autophagy working.
Mm. So you've just sort of mentioned how there are certain things that can enhance or increase autophagy while some things can sort of hinder it. So let's sort of look at perhaps some lifestyle habits that can enhance autophagy.
I think it may be true that, that there is some autophagy happening all the time. It's just like to a lesser degree. And like you said, there are some activities that enhance it further. And in research, it mostly has to do with some aspects of like energy, stress, and like nutrient deprivation. So when your body is under a higher amount of like loads, some sort of, let's say, exercise or fasting, then it's going to, in response, going to upregulate the process of autophagy as a way to like, survive and also, deal with the stress to a certain extent. So everything like exercise, fasting, calorie restriction, saunas, the cold, even like hypoxia, oxygen deprivation, and different kinds of, let's say foods like, coffee, teas, different vegetables, polyphenols, and those things, they cause like a small amount of energy stress to the body. And that those do like enhance the process of autophagy or like increase some of the activity of it.
Interesting. So from like a supplementation or like a drug standpoint, do you have sort of like your favorite sort of supplements that can activate or stimulate autophagy?
Hmm. Of course, there is like these, the bigger ones, the more known ones are like myosin and metformin, which are like anti-diabetic drugs and supposedly also longevity drugs that activate autophagy by suppressing the growth pathways in the body. I don't use them, but what I, you know, on a regular basis can use would be like maybe berberine. It's kind of my favorite ones because it's like a natural metformin in a sense that it also lowers insulin and blood sugar, and it turns on like it's an AMPK activator, which is one of the sensors that leads to the elevation of autophagy as well. So berberine is just like a safe, you know, thing that you can use. I usually take it on some days when I eat like carbohydrates or something. I don't take it all the time because that's not, you know, necessarily a good idea. But yeah, whenever I do have, let's say, eaten something with higher carbs, then I'll take that and can kind of mitigate some of the blood sugar response from that.
Interesting. Okay. So Sim, did you ever sort of get into, did you get into sort of tracking your ketones at all, like in the early days?
Well, yeah, in the beginning, I did for sure. Like not like neurotically or not all the time, but I would, let's say, use the finger, the blood ketone test with the finger prick maybe, I don't know, a few times a week. So yeah, usually, yeah, I just looked at some of the, you know, maybe if I changed something in my diet or if I ate a bit more carbs, I wanted to see like how it would affect my ketones. And but I've also used like the breath ketone meter, the acetone breath, and that's more or less easier to do, and they're going to track your ketones more frequently.
Yeah, because I was curious to know whether supplementing with berberine was sort of enhancing ketone output, or like, did you ever see any correlation there at all?
I didn't measure it if I were to be like on full keto already, or I didn't take a berberine. I don't take it usually at that time either. But I do notice that if I do take berberine, then the suppression of ketones is much less after eating carbs, so to say. Like if I regularly eat carbs without berberine, then my ketones are going to be much lower compared to if I do take berberine. Then my ketones are going to be still, you know, semi-high thanks to that, so that the blood sugar response has interfered less with the ketone body production.
Interesting. Okay. So obviously you mentioned how autophagy is considered one of the sort of, it definitely affects lifespan and aging. So what are some of the other key hallmarks of aging that we know about?
Yeah, the there's a bunch of them, and you know, usually they have to do with some sort of intracellular miscommunication or something that the cells and the body, the organs, they start to essentially communicate with each other in a wrong way and a dysfunctional way. Then there's also like the accumulation of these waste material, as well as the, you know, the mitochondria get damaged, the cells themselves become dysfunctional and damaged with age. There's the also, you know, stem cells get exhausted, your body's ability to produce hormones goes down, the ability to build muscle decreases, and yeah, just almost like this, you know, that you can't really pinpoint it to an exact one thing that is going to happen or what goes wrong, but you can look at it almost like this, you know, like a central miscommunication or a central like epigenetic, I don't know, misfiring or something that the body just loses it or forgets about its ability to be young. Like the DNA gets damaged or DNA methylation profiles get altered. And as a result, the like aging pathways get upregulated and the longevity pathways, the youthful pathways get downregulated. And because of that, you know, the body just starts to accelerate this biological aging process.
Yeah, one thing that we can definitely link in here with this conversation is the state of one's mitochondrial health, and whether there's sort of an impact there. Like, does autophagy influence mitochondrial function at all?
Yeah, it certainly does. Like, there's actually like a ton of different categories of autophagy, and one of the main ones is mitophagy, which is the autophagy of mitochondria. And you know, mitophagy is you know, eliminates these broken mitochondria and old mitochondria, and keeps them basically more youthful, or keeps the younger ones alive. And the mitochondria are always like, you know, in this between fission and fusion cycles, they're, you know, merging together or breaking up, and autophagy just helps to kind of clean house, and yeah, just keeps things in order. Because, you know, the problem with these damaged mitochondria is that, you know, they stick around and they start to spread inflammation and they damage the neighboring healthy ones. And the same applies to like the cells. Like if a cell is old and becomes diseased, then it's not going to just stay there like neutrally. It's going to actually start to spread the damage to the neighboring cells. And if it becomes like this senescent cell, which is like a zombie cell, and this senescence spreads, and this kind of spreads the inflammation and aging further. So you kind of need to eliminate them on a regular basis. And autophagy and these other, you know, self-cleaning processes in the body, they help to do that.
So from a mitochondrial perspective, just curious to know, I mean, I've got my favorite mitochondrial enhancers, things like methylene blue, things like coenzyme Q10, acetyl-L-carnitine. Just curious to know, Sim, like what's your favorite sort of biohack that really helps to optimize mitochondrial function?
Yeah, well, I do take CoQ10 as well, and I do like sometimes may take PQQ as well, but like the biggest ones in my opinion are like actually like exercise and that sort of thing, like the hormetic stressors, because they're gonna trigger this the growth of new mitochondria through mitochondrial biogenesis, as well as enhance like mitochondrial density. So you know, that's usually, I think those are actually more, let's say, you know, functional ways of enhancing mitochondrial longevity.
Interesting. Okay. So, yeah, one thing I've always wanted to know is it possible to assess someone's mitochondrial function? Like, do we have any, is there objective data to verify this at all?
Yeah, that's a good question. Off the top of my head, like, I don't really know. Maybe... Yeah, like, yeah, it's hard to kind of assess that unless you have like a specific, like I don't even imagine like how would you go about measuring it? Like, you have to do like a laboratory test or something.
Maybe.
Or do you assess like the fitness of the person, like VO2 max or something? I don't know. Maybe like a combination of all those things.
Maybe, yeah, a combination of VO2 max plus like a muscle biopsy, maybe assessing like type 1 skeletal muscle fibers. Not sure, but yeah, that'll be interesting. So what about, obviously, you know, you mentioned this term hormesis, and I know you talk about this quite a lot. I'm very familiar with it, but do you want to explain to my audience, like, what is the term hormesis? And I guess, why is it so important for longevity?
Hormesis is basically what doesn't kill me makes me stronger. So it's like a dose-specific response to any kind of a stressor or a toxin or injury that in a small amount or in the moderate dose is going to be actually enhancing and like beneficial, but in excess, it's going to be damaging, like anything. So yeah, it's like a bell curve. It's actually like, you know, a good example is exercise. If you don't exercise at all, you're in very low hormesis or very low stress, then you actually are at a higher risk of all these diseases as well, because your body is, you know, less fit, it's less insulin sensitive, you're sedentary, and your risk of diseases goes up because you actually don't experience enough stress. If you exercise enough in moderation in the right amounts, then that's, you know, the optimal zone. You're getting all the benefits of that. You're increasing your longevity and health span. But if you overtrain, you know, that's also bad, because that leads to, you know, other kinds of problems, maybe suppressed immune system and sleeping problems, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, it's a bell curve. Not enough is good. Too much is bad. And you know, the optimal amount is in somewhere in the middle.
So from like a dietary perspective, I know we talk about compounds like sulforaphane, which do act as a hormetic stress in the body, but it makes me sort of wonder whether having a cheat meal is, you know, like an aspect of hormesis, right?
Right. Well, yeah, I can see that, because, you know, it can definitely apply to some of the foods that you eat, let's say gluten. So if you are on a gluten-free diet all the time, like year-round, and then you you accidentally eat some gluten, then your body's kind of have maybe like a harder time dealing with it, because you kind of forgot about how to actually, you know, deal with the gluten. Whereas if you like microdose the gluten like every few times a month or something, then you're keeping like this immune system memory alive, and you're able to, you know, deal with it a lot better. So yeah, that can apply to, you know, every different kinds of these allergens and different kinds of, let's say, bad foods. Of course, there are some foods that don't really have like a hormetic effect, like, I don't know, vegetable oils or margarine. Those probably don't have any hormesis, but let's say some other safer foods tend to be okay. Plus, like from a psychological side, if you get freaked out, if you get stressed out because of being afraid of eating like the bad food, then that can actually cause like more damage to your system compared to just, you know, eating it and being at ease with it because you know your body can deal with it. So like a healthy body should be able to, you know, get exposed to like a lot of stress and be able to recover from it instead of just being like isolated from the world completely.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned the aspect of sort of like microdosing a stressor. One area that I've sort of been exploring recently, I don't know if you've had any experience with homeopathy.
Well, I've heard about it. Yeah. It's, you know, a traditional type of medicine.
Obviously, like, I mean, I get cautious mentioning homeopathy anywhere I go because a lot of people say it's all placebo, there's no science or whatever. But I think, I guess, like, the principle around that really is just, like, you know, some of the remedies, like, there's one particular remedy that I used was actually the remedy that it actually killed Socrates. It's called Conium maculatum. It's like a particular plant. And I had the homeopathic remedy of it. And actually, you know, even though it's poisonous in large amounts at a micro homeopathic level, it definitely had some degree of psychoactivity to it. So, yeah, I guess the term hormesis, like you said, can be applied across many aspects of, you know, one's lifestyle. So how would you encourage people to integrate hormesis? Like, where would you encourage people to start?
Most important thing is probably, you know, exercise itself, because you know, exercise will improve the quality of your life and your let's say fitness and well-being and longevity, even if you didn't change anything else. Even if you kept eating like a bad diet, just implementing exercise at least will help you to get away with it a bit more. And it's like one of the most powerful drugs, if you can call it that, and it's very like very strong therapeutic for a lot of things. That's the first thing that you should do, like both cardiovascular exercise and resistance training. After that, I would say that you should also maybe implement some form of this time-restricted eating, that you eliminate snacks, and instead of eating, you know, from sunrise to sundown, you want to confine it a little bit to some time frame, because that's, you know, also an aspect of hormesis. Plus, there's a lot of other benefits to this confining your eating window. That's going to help with like blood sugar regulation, helps to lower blood pressure, improves other biomarkers, and improves sleep. So it's also, and plus, you know, elevates autophagy as well. So it's a very easy way to gain some effects of hormesis.
Mm. So this time-restricted eating, I know that you went through a period of time where you were fasting almost every day, right? Like for a number of years, is that right?
Well, I've been doing it, every day for the last like 8 years or something. Oh. So yeah, I haven't like, you know, stopped, or I haven't had a reason to why would I quit.
So do you want to explain your particular protocol?
Yeah, like in the past, like I began with just eating twice a day, at, you know, 16 hour fasting and 8 hour eating window. Nowadays, for the last few years, I've been doing like one meal a day mostly. And that isn't like necessarily precisely one meal a day, but it's almost like I eat one meal a day, but during my workout, I have like basically a protein shake. And the idea is to, you know, it's very hard to build muscle and build strength with just one meal a day. Having the protein shake helps me to basically sidestep that and still be able to make progress. So yeah, that's how I do it.
Mm. So this time-restricted eating, what do we know in terms of metabolic health just by, even if we're consuming the same number of calories? I think there's one particular study where they're having the same number of calories, but they're consuming it in a specific time period. What sort of outcomes can people see just by adhering to that?
Yeah, there are actually both the human and animal studies that show that, yeah, the restricted eating window, even if you are eating the same amount of calories, mostly it has to do with like better blood sugar, lower insulin, lower triglycerides, better cholesterol, lower blood pressure, and that sort of thing, as well as like increase in the autophagy activation. Even in some mice studies where the mice are on a junk food diet, they're overeating calories. But if the mice is eating their food in a smaller time frame, like once a day versus the entire day, then they're leaner, they're healthier compared to the same mice who are eating the same amount of calories. So it is like a pretty powerful intervention in that. But I do think, you know, for humans, you still need to restrict your calories if you want to lose weight a little bit. But, you know, arguably, you maybe need to do it a bit less, maybe like a few percent less to see those same effects. And some people even think that this eating window, the restricted eating window, would also help to, let's say, achieve the longevity benefits of calorie restriction without necessarily needing to restrict calories. So in animal studies, it's very known that calorie restriction increases lifespan. But the problem is that, you know, for humans, it's very hard to stick to, and they're most likely going to fall off the wagon. And the intermittent fasting essentially helps to mimic the effects of calorie restriction by turning on the same pathways as calorie restriction does, but you don't need to restrict the calories that much to see those effects.
Mm. Now, recently, Sim, you spoke about a particular study that was like a three-week long study extending lifespan in humans. Is that right?
Yeah. It was quite a recent study in April, I think. And they took 40 or 50 people, older men in the 50s and 70s. And they basically put them on this routine where they exercised regularly. They slept well, they did breathing exercises, and they did actually this time restricted eating of fasting for at least 12 hours a day. And their diet was it wasn't like a vegan diet, it wasn't like a carnivore diet, it was like actually a pretty good balanced diet. They ate some grass-fed meat every day, like 6 ounces of grass-fed meat every day. Wow. And a bunch of these also dark leafy greens, different sulforaphane-containing vegetables, and colorful vegetables, as well as a little bit of like pumpkin seeds or maybe berries, and like a plant polyphenol powder, and that includes all these like methyl donors and polyphenolic activators. So, and as a result of that, after 8 weeks, they saw that their biological age was decreased by 3 years. Wow. Which is, you know, quite fast the results.
Amazing. Well, hopefully I'll link that study in the show notes, because that's quite a fascinating finding. One other thing I wanted to add, Sim, was just personally, I got myself a CGM device, started tracking my glucose, and I personally noticed that if I consumed 100 grams of white rice after say 8 p.m. or 9 p.m. versus 100 grams of white rice at lunchtime, the glucose spike was much more pronounced in the evening. So do you want to sort of explain how that sort of linked in with the time-restricted eating?
Yeah, our bodies have their own circadian rhythms, and based upon those circadian rhythms, we produce different hormones. And by default, we are very more insulin sensitive during the daytime when the sun is out, and around the noon is where we are most insulin sensitive, which means that we will be most effective in clearing the bloodstream from glucose and lowering it down. So if you eat later in the day, then your insulin sensitivity goes down, and just because of that, you would have like a higher elevation of the blood sugar a bit for longer. Arguably you could say that we should eat then during the daytime most of our calories for sure, and at least like not in the middle of the night we shouldn't eat. And but at the same time, there's also the thing that although your natural insulin production goes down in the evening, you can also still make yourself very insulin sensitive by exercising before you eat. So one of the most the best way to actually make yourself insulin sensitive is to do resistance training. And resistance training activates this GLUT4 receptor, which basically allows the glucose to enter the muscle cells without the use of insulin. And so you can just, even if you eat later in the day, if you exercise before that, then you shouldn't have like a big problem with the blood sugar regulation.
Mm, yeah. Well said. So now let's sort of segue into sort of discussing minerals, because I feel like a lot of these minerals get neglected when it comes to optimizing health. So I guess, Sam, do you want to explore the importance of minerals in the body in relation to energy?
Yeah, for sure. Like minerals are very underrated, and they're almost like, you know, the different fuel sources that actually run all these processes inside the body. And they help to produce energy, they help to produce neurotransmitters, they help with immunity and digestion and production of hormones, etc. So it's a very important thing. In relation to energy production specifically, then in the mitochondrial electron transport chain, then there's different complexes inside there, and all those complexes require certain minerals to basically conduct the process and produce ATP. So those minerals are mostly with, like, magnesium is the biggest one. There's also copper, iron, sodium, and zinc. Those things are all different parts of the electron transport chain and the complexes.
So then I guess, like, with the most common mineral deficiencies, obviously every second naturopath and functional medicine doctor talks about the implications of magnesium deficiency. So I'm going to try and steer clear of magnesium, but I want to sort of focus on some of the other minerals. Like you mentioned copper. Do you want to elaborate further on that?
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the biggest deficiencies in like mineral deficiencies in the world is actually iron deficiency, or considered to be, like, 25% of the people worldwide are considered to be iron deficient. But, you know, the reality is that this iron deficiency anemia may not be actually caused by iron deficiency, because, you know, iron itself, you know, consuming more iron doesn't necessarily mean that it gets activated or that it gets, you know, utilized properly. So for proper iron utilization, you actually need copper. So copper, activates this, or copper is used for this another, let's say, a hormone or enzyme in the body called caruloplasmin. And the caruloplasmin activates iron, basically, and, improves its utilization and hemoglobin production. So if you are deficient in copper, then you're getting more iron, especially from supplements, isn't gonna do the trick in most cases. So actually, iron deficiency anemia can be actually maybe a copper deficiency, and usually there's also a lot of reflex in the diet. You get a lot of iron from muscle meat and let's say fortified cereals, but you don't get the copper from liver and maybe dark chocolate and this beans and stuff. So yeah, like most people are getting enough iron. It's just that it's not really utilized properly and activated.
Yeah, and I want to add something to that, Sim, in relation to copper and how a lot of people tend to mega dose zinc. And so, you know, we know that zinc has an antagonistic effect on copper. So, you know, let's sort of discuss the relationships there.
Yeah, zinc does, like, reduce copper absorption. So if you are taking, let's say, a zinc supplement, then you also need to increase your copper intake for that. And the ratios for that, if I'm not mistaken, are supposed to be like 20 to 1 or something, that 20 per 20 grams of zinc, you would need like one extra gram of copper, if I'm not mistaken. So that's kind of the ratios. So if you're taking a zinc supplement, then prolong the zinc supplementation is not a good idea anyway. So you don't want to use it only like, you know, infrequently, or if you have some infection or something. At other times, just eating a lot of oysters. If you eat a lot of oysters or foods that have zinc, then you would also need to have foods that have a bit more copper. So muscle meat is also a bit higher in zinc, definitely higher in zinc than it is in copper.
Yeah, let's talk about calcium, because I mean, like I said before, everyone talks about magnesium, but there's a lot of people that can't tolerate dairy. So from the calcium perspective, what do you, you know, what sort of calcium rich foods do you lean towards?
Yeah, like I do have like a bit of the dairy because I can tolerate it, but if you have some dairy intolerance, then the best kind of foods for that are like actually fish bones, you know, sardines. If you eat the sardines with the bones, then you're getting some good calcium from that. And also, like, you know, the different broths, like ribs, if you like tendons, ligaments, chicken drumsticks, you get some calcium from that as well. Or, you know, eggshells, like eggshell powder is something some people use. If you grind it up and you can just mix it into some foods or something and take as a supplement. Those are kind of good alternatives. And, you know, of course, there's some calcium in these dark leafy greens as well, vegetables and things, but it's, you know, arguably a bit less bioavailable.
Mm. So what about chromium? Because chromium is often considered, you know, one of the anti-diabetic minerals. Do you want to, what's your stance there on chromium and where do you prefer to get your chromium from?
Yeah, chromium is mostly has to do with better blood sugar regulation by like enhancing insulin production. And like chromium supplementation itself doesn't seem to be like, you know, that effective or that beneficial for people who don't have diabetes. But if you have insulin resistance or diabetes, then it does appear to have like at least some benefit in lowering fasting blood sugar and fasting insulin levels. I personally do take chromium as well on some days. I eat carbs again to kind of help with the blood sugar regulation. But on a daily basis, some chromium are things like broccoli, chocolate again, and beans. So yeah, oatmeal actually has it as well. And the kind of biggest source of chromium is like these mussels, these seafood, and those are quite rich in the chromium.
Mm. Awesome. Okay. So let's sort of discuss, you sort of touched on iron, you know, that's a sort of a mineral that can be difficult for people to, you know, increase their levels. But what are some other minerals that people might be toxic in?
Hmm. Yeah. Well, actually, I think excess iron is, you know, quite bad, and it's definitely one of the easiest ways to, let's say, overdo if you're eating a lot of muscle meat or if you're eating these fortified cereals, breads, and the like, you know, granolas, things like that. Those have like added iron in there, so like iron supplementation is definitely quite like dangerous actually, because it increases like risk of like liver damage, and you know, cardiovascular disease increase risk goes up as well because of that. You know, excess iron is gonna just, you know, cause oxidative stress in the body, so I wouldn't like really recommend supplementing iron ever if you actually have like some serious medical condition or you're like severely anemic. But like I said, in most cases, iron deficiency can be fixed like either like just eating more muscle meat or increasing your copper intake. Next to that, the calcium supplementation also appears to be not toxic, but, you know, it's can be dangerous by increasing the risk of calcification and cardiovascular disease, atherosclerosis, which doesn't apply to calcium from the real food. So you could be getting like the same amount of calcium from food, but it doesn't, at least in studies, it doesn't increase the risk of these calcification and atherosclerosis, but the calcium supplementation does, even if it's like the same amount, which is, you know, quite interesting. Calcium supplementation I wouldn't really take either, unless maybe you're like severely old and you're not eating any calcium at all from your diet, but most people don't really shouldn't do it. And lastly, maybe I would say, you know, copper supplementation can also be bad. Like, you know, too much copper can suppress your immunity and also cause like liver damage. So most people aren't getting enough copper from their food, but taking like a copper supplement or like, let's say, drinking water from like copper pipes or something, that can also lead to the accumulation of too much copper in the body.
Mm. So apart from sort of like objective blood testing for minerals, do you have any other sort of signs or like what, how do you go by assessing the mineral status of an individual?
Yeah, well, I think there's a different methods for like each mineral. Some people use like hair mineral analysis, like for example, for magnesium, just a red blood cell magnesium count is you know, does suffice. So yeah, different kinds of minerals have different tests. But yeah, I would, you know, try to, like the blood test is usually the kind of easiest way to kind of assess something, and then also kind of pair it with like your symptoms. like, do you feel the symptoms of a particular deficiency? Or, and not if you don't feel any symptoms, then you're probably fine. So it's kind of also can be something to overthink a little bit because, like, you know, the body is, you know, very adaptable, and we don't like really fully understand all these different relationships between these minerals.
Awesome. Okay. So, Sim, let's sort of segue onto sleep optimization, because you've provided some pretty amazing resources in the realm of sleep optimization. So just curious to know some of your favorite sleep hacks.
I do like to use, you know, these blue blockers, because it's very effective for filtering out the blue light and enabling your melatonin production in the evening. That's also like when I saw quite a large increase in my deep sleep. So when I started using the blue blockers, then my deep sleep scores increased by 15% with the measurement of the Oura Ring. So it does work in a sense. Other things that I do, you know, think that it's also important to get exposed to this daylight during the daytime, especially in the morning, in the AM, because this sunlight exposure and like, you know, producing vitamin D and the circadian rhythm alignment helps you to produce melatonin at night as well. So if you're, let's say, it increases like your sleep drive. If you're, the more sunlight you're exposed to, then the higher your sleep drive is going to be in the evening. And the more melatonin you're going to produce as well, which is, you know, actually interesting, because like plants that are exposed to a lot of sunlight also have a higher content of melatonin in them, like foods, like the dark cherries, etc. Those foods are very high in melatonin because, you know, they're sitting out in the sun all the time. And so, yeah, you do want to, you know, you don't want to be stuck indoors all the time, which is one of the reasons why people may not feel tired in the evening. Just, you know, they're stuck indoors in front of their computer and just getting exposed to this blue light.
Awesome. Okay. So what sort of tips would you give someone if they're constantly traveling and they're changing sort of time zone? What are your go-to sort of, like, how would you biohack jet lag?
Whenever I fly and travel, then I'm always like fasting on the plane. So because it's actually very, very good for preventing jet lag and being able to adapt to the new time zone easily, because you're like, your metabolism is almost like in suspended state if you're fasting. And when you reintroduce foods in the new time zone, then kind of the body adjusts to it a little bit better. And it's also like very good for mitigating the negative side effects of being in this airplane, in this metal box in the air, because like you are exposed to some radiation from the sun up in the air. And like fasting actually does, let's say, reduce the effects of radiation by like with the process of autophagy and these other pathways. They help you to deal with the stress. And also, like, you know, chemotherapy patients, if they fast before getting their treatment, then they basically recover better, a bit better, and they have like less of these negative side effects.
Awesome.
And, you know, when it comes to like sleep per se, then I would say learning how to take like naps, you know, this polyphasic sleeping is something that I'm like really good at. And I'm able to like take these different naps at different times. And this helps to kind of, you know, deal with the sleep deprivation as well as adjust to the new time zone a bit better.
You know, when I was researching a little bit on sleep in quite some time ago, I remember coming across some of the old school ways of viewing, you know, historical sleep patterns in humans. Was it correct that some humans used to, you know, sleep for 4 hours, wake up and do things and then go back to sleep for is it biphasic sleep?
Probably did, because, you know, yeah, the back in the day, they didn't have safe houses. They were like living in the bush. So, they had to have like some sentries or someone to keep guard and guard the flame, etc. So, yeah, there are actually like different chronotypes in people. So some people are morning people, some are night owls. So, yeah, I think that, yeah, some people are genetically more prone to like stay up later and wake up later as well as a result. And, yeah, I do think, you know, this, let's say, monophasic sleep, the one that we're doing in Western society is that we sleep from like, you know, evening until morning in one block, like 7 to 8 hours in one go. That's monophasic sleep. That's not, that's actually very rare in nature and in hunter-gatherer societies. In most hunter-gatherers, they do something like a biphasic sleep, which is like, you know, two blocks of sleep where they sleep maybe 4 hours, stay up 1 to 2 hours again and sleep again for another 3 or something hours. And, you know, there's actually like more advanced polyphasic sleeping schedules, like triphasic sleep. There's a Uberman sleep where you actually sleep only for 20 minutes at a time, 8 times a day. So yeah, there's different ways of going about it. And yeah, I think yeah, like some aspects of like biphasic sleep is probably something that we're, you know, hardwired to do. Like, you know, the siesta sleep is the most popular forms of that. In Mediterranean countries, they take a nap in the afternoon, but they sleep a bit shorter.
Yeah, you mentioned that you're getting quite good at, you know, implementing and deploying the naps. So like if you go beyond 30 minutes, or like, do you have a set time zone for that?
I usually don't because most of the time I do wake up automatically after like 30 minutes or something. If I don't, then I would maybe sleep a bit longer, like 60 minutes or... yeah, but yeah, it depends on how tired I am. If I'm like really tired, then sometimes I can even sleep for an hour and a half. Depends on how much sleep that I get the night before. But yeah, like ideally, you would want to keep the naps a bit shorter, like, you know, 20 to 30 minutes, because of if you know, go into the full sleep cycle around like, you know, 60 minutes, then you may get waken up at the middle of it, which can make you like you're very tired and groggy, so you actually feel worse than you did before going to the nap. So yeah, like if you take a nap, then it should be either like, you know, 30, 20 minutes or the full sleep cycle, which lasts for up to 90 minutes.
Mm, okay. Curious to know, Sim, like your stance on caffeine.
Yeah, well, I do like it. I consume it on a regular basis. And yeah, it's, you know, the research does indicate it is pretty healthy for you in a good amount, in moderation. And yeah, I try to not drink it. I usually drink only like, you know, 1 to 2 cups a day at maximum. So yeah, I'm not like addicted to it. I use it mostly for just performance and focus and things. And yeah, I don't have it later in the day. I usually have it around like maybe 11, 12 at the latest.
Yeah, so let's sort of segue and discuss some of the performance, you know, strength and working out exercise, because you've packed on quite a lot of muscle in the last probably 6 months or so. So let's talk about, I guess, some of the training techniques and how they differ for like building muscle versus building strength.
Yeah, well, usually if you are getting stronger, then some muscle growth is also going to happen. But not, you know, that you can also be like a power lifter that minimizes muscle growth or muscle size and focuses only on like muscle strength and density. So there are different types of muscle hypertrophy. Myofibrillar hypertrophy is basically like the strength side that your muscle.
So you're sort of mentioning from like the strength based activities, things like that. You mentioned how power lifters, you know, train for strength versus not so much for hypertrophy. So do you want to expand upon that?
Yeah, there's different types of muscle hypertrophy. Myofibrillar hypertrophy is like the powerlifter side, that the muscle fibers become more dense and like more efficient at the firing, whereas the sarcoplasmic hypertrophy is the bodybuilder aspect, where the muscle fibers, you know, expand and get bigger, hold more fluid, etc. So you know, any kind of resistance training can cause both adaptations. It's just a matter of, you know, how you train. Usually it has to do with like the amount of intensity that you use and the volume. So the kind of near maximum effort that the powerlifters do, or weightlifters, around like 90% of their maximum and 100%. That is mostly training this myofibrillar hypertrophy, and the sarcoplasmic hypertrophy is usually around, you know, anything above 60 to 80%, somewhere between there is going to be sarcoplasmic hypertrophy. I you know, I do train both. I focus on strength mostly, and I add some, let's say, bodybuilding exercises as well into the mix to promote some sarcoplasmic hypertrophy. But yeah, like the most important part of building muscle is progressive overload. So you want to get stronger, over time, increase the weights, and you measure progressive overloads by, you know, adding more weights, doing more reps, doing more volume, maybe resting less in between sets. All those things can be a sign of progressive overload. But the main idea is that you always want to keep pushing the envelope of increasing the intensity or increasing the weight you lift and making it a bit harder. So it's never going to get easier. It's always it should be always as hard as it is the stronger you get or the more muscle you build.
I'm glad you mentioned the progressive overload aspect and not only focusing just on the weight aspect, but, you know, decreasing the rest time, maybe increasing the time under tension. A lot of people don't realize that, you know, we can challenge the body by altering the aspect of progressive overload. But there's one aspect that I really want to look at, and that is the differences between concentric, eccentric, and isometric. I know there's a lot of research that shows that eccentric is excellent for hypertrophy, but what about isometric?
Yeah, you're right. Like the eccentric causes like the most muscle damage, and as a result, you promote the most sarcoplasmic hypertrophy, and it also releases actually the most growth hormone. So it gets like the biggest like hormonal effect. When it comes to the isometric, then isometrics are amazing for strength because of your like you know resisting, you're holding it in place in static holds. Then that is the best for strength because you're also like stabilizing your body at the same time. And, you know, all these gymnasts, they do like the front levers and planches and iron crosses. Those are isometric exercises and they require a ton of strength. And this isometric does carry over to, you know, pure strength in the sense. So it's also like, you know, is also like the best for, you know, injuries and like strengthening the tendons if you do these isometrics because you're focusing solely on the form and just, getting a ton of like blood flow and this response in those regions. The concentric movement, I think that's, you know, also more appropriate for strength because you're like, usually you would have to do it like the most explosive, the fastest as you can. So that is good for strength as well as like power in general. Like weightlifters, they like weightlifters and powerlifters, they actually minimize the eccentric portion as much as possible. So they actually like drop the weight so that they wouldn't do like the negative part so that they would only train the speed and power so that their muscle fibers would be firing as fast as possible. So yeah, those are kind of the different types.
So what influence do you think like the variety of the exercise? Because, you know, like some people that start a brand new exercise, they get severe DOMS and some people even gauge. Mm-hmm. At one point I was like, if I'm not sore, there's no way I'm building muscle. So like,
Well, yeah, if you are doing something new, some new exercise, or you're training in a different rep range, then it causes more soreness because your body like isn't used to it and it causes like more damage. But as you get more adapted, then the amount of soreness and this DOMS also decreases. But it doesn't mean that you stop making gains. So you still have to focus on the progressive overload. That is like the biggest contributor factor. Like progressive overload isn't the only thing that contributes to muscle growth, but it is maybe like, you know, 70 or 80% of the equation almost. And the rest of it does come from like muscle damage, which is, you know, the pump and things like that. The novelty is also a contributor, but it's not, you know, the focus that you should. You shouldn't do like this muscle confusion all the time. It is a good idea to, you know, mix it up every once in a while to bring your body a new stimulus, but it shouldn't be something that you do like every week, new exercise, new program, etc. You have to have like this progressive overload still in play.
You know what's funny, Sim, is like, have you ever thought about like people that are in prison? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm sure that they do, you know, some crazy reps, like 200 chin-ups a day or whatever, but they're jacked. Like they get so big. Like, what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, well, they probably have like this very high frequency training. So, you know, they don't have anything else to do in the prison. So they're just training and they're doing almost every day. So frequency is also like a pretty underrated aspect to muscle growth and strength. Because of, you know, if you are doing it very often, then your body has no other reason to kind of not adapt because it detects the needs that it needs to be stronger. But, you know, probably if you have this high frequency, then you also need to kind of dial down some of the intensity. So you can't really go max out every day and do a bunch of volume and frequency all at once because you're going to burn out. So, you know, when it comes to bodyweight exercises, then as you get really good at pull-ups, you can do like 20 or 30 pull-ups, then that intensity isn't that high. Like it's relatively like, you know, moderate intensity to you because you're really good at it. And because of that, you can increase the frequency, so to say. If you're able to do 20 to 30 pull-ups, then doing it every day doesn't cause nearly as much muscle damage as for someone who can only do, 10 pull-ups, it does. So yeah, like manipulating these different variables of the training, you can also see some great results. And, personally, I've also done like this high volume, high frequency pull-up routines, like 100 pull-ups every day for a month. But because of, dialing down some of the intensity, it's still like another different new stimulus that you can use to build muscle.
Because that would, it makes me wonder whether they would look at us and think, there's no such thing as overtraining. Like they must think that, we're weak, and like think about their diet as well. There's no way they're getting 1.6 to 2.2 grams of protein per kilogram, right?
Right. Yeah, probably not. It's just the high frequency. So it's like even like, farmers who they don't, train bodybuilding exercises, but they have like, big forearms and stuff like that because of, using their arms all day. But it's at like a very low intensity. It's not like a maxed out, at least not all the time.
Mm. So what about like timing of exercise? Like, do you have a preferred time to exercise or like what is there any fascinating research you found in this realm?
Yeah, well, from a, like a circadian rhythm perspective, the muscle strength and power does peak around like 4 or 5 p.m. in the afternoon. So that is, I would say like that can be considered like the best time to exercise from like a, just a performance perspective. But, any time is still the best that you can do it. So I think I do personally work out at around like 4 or 5. That's usually just, I think it's mostly has to do with also like your habits and how you feel. Like different people have a different circadian rhythms as well.
Mm. Yeah, I find that I'm similar to you in that regard. I prefer to train around 4 or 5 p.m. or usually, first thing in the morning. I find that works best. From a protein intake perspective, we're constantly at wrestle with longevity versus performance. Restricting mm-hmm. protein will extend lifespan, but we also want to build muscle at the same time. So what's your sweet spot with protein intake?
I try to aim for this 1 gram per pound of body weight, which is, you don't really need more than that. And more of that is going to be probably like just a waste. When it comes to, the longevity side, then, unless you are eating, 2 or 3 grams per pound of body weight, then that's, the protein is probably not going to have, like, any real negative side effects on your longevity. It's actually maybe beneficial because of, increasing muscle and strength, so maintaining your health span for longer. And even, most of the, like, protein restriction helping with longevity is, there's no, like, real human studies that show it. Most of it has to do with like cell and animal studies. And even then, if you are doing, let's say this time restricted eating or intermittent fasting, then, I think that would also negate the potential like side effects of having like a higher protein intake. Because when you are fasting, then you're suppressing all these growth pathways that the protein stimulates already. Like you're keeping the mTOR pathway low, your IGF-1 low, and upregulating autophagy and things. So you're balancing it out. And if you are eating twice a day, then it doesn't matter that you're eating like a higher protein intake. And also like, the glycine supplementation has been shown to negate the harmful effects of excess methionine, which you get from a muscle meat. So if you are eating only muscle meat, then that may not be the best thing. So you want to kind of either get the glycine from these tendons and ligaments, drumsticks, etc., or glycine from like a supplement.
I'm glad you brought that up because I just did a video on the carnivore diet, exploring the benefits and the drawbacks. I'm curious mm-hmm. to hear your opinion. Like, did you ever experiment on the carnivore diet? What's your opinion there?
I've never done it for like any longer than a week or so. Because I don't really feel that I need to do it, and I haven't, I haven't noticed any difference as well. So yeah, I think it can be good for some people who have like autoimmune issues, or they have some gut issues they want to deal with. But you know, is it needed for everyone to do? Probably not. Like most people are fine, like tolerating even like gluten and the dairy and these other like allergens and anti-nutrients, they're just fine. And yeah, this is just a specific group of people who may have to resort to that. I think it actually maybe not the best thing to do it for like a long term either if you're healthy, like because you may develop these intolerances just by avoiding those foods, and you may have like a harder time getting back on track. So yeah, from a longevity perspective, you know, if you're eating only meat, then you are avoiding a lot of these potential harmful foods like vegetable oils and sugars and other processed foods. So just by virtue of that, you may see like an improvement in your health, that you lose weight, you also see maybe like lower blood sugar, etc. and that sort of thing. But personally I think that implementing some plants is definitely better, because you do get like some harmful compounds from the meat as well if you only eat meat, like iron, for example. If you eat only muscle meat, then you are getting basically way too much iron. And do one of the best ways to actually lower iron or chelate it is with coffee and teas, and also like the vegetables. They help to kind of bind the iron and get rid of it.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. And there's one other thing I'd like to add to that is we must not forget the anti-cancer molecules found within plants, like resveratrol, sulforaphane, and pterostilbene in blueberries. Like, I think there's definitely a time and place, for the carnivore diet. It can be a powerful tool, like you said, for autoimmune diseases. But long term, I just don't see it as a very sustainable option. So, Sim, where can this has been an action packed episode? Where can my listeners, learn more, connect with you, follow your channels? I know you have a book you've just recently written with Dr. James Di Nicolantonio. So, do you want to share where people can find that?
Yeah, well, my website is seemlund.com, and I'm also Seemlund on all the social media apps, and their books are all on Amazon.
Awesome. So I'll make sure to leave them linked in the show notes. Sim, thanks for coming on the show, man. It's been a pleasure having you.
Yeah, it was a great talking with you.
Awesome.
Thank you, everyone, for joining in to today's episode. For in-depth show notes and lessons learned, visit nofilter.media/boost your biology.
This has been a No Filter Media production.
Say what you want.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.